16. The heat was unbearable. Agent Miller tried to get his mind off of the heat by focusing on the noise, which was deafening. After a few minutes of this, he tried to distract himself from the noise by focusing on his motion sickness, which threatened to make him throw up at any moment. In an effort to alleviate this, he crawled closer to the open door of the unrefrigerated boxcar in which he was riding.
Maybe if I look at the horizon, I won't be sick. That's supposed to help. Besides, it's cooler there because of the wind.
He crawled as close to the door as he dared, close enough to feel that the wind was still unnervingly strong and gusty, and to see that the train was still cutting along the side of a mountain, so that the door of the boxcar opened to a life-ending drop. Not a straight drop. There was a painful-looking gravel berm just wide enough for him to bounce off of before he fell over the side to his certain death. His innate fear of heights and his lack of any decent footing drove Agent Miller clambering back into the dark corner of the boxcar, where it was safe, hot, and loud.
"I hate this!"
he shouted.
"What?"
Jimmy shouted back. It would have been hard enough to hear each other if they had only had the train noise to contend with. But because of Jimmy's weird effect on electronic devices, they'd had to find a train going from Seattle to Los Angeles that had three non-refrigerated boxcars in a row that weren't transporting any sort of electronic devices, and in which the middle car had room for three adults to live for the 3 days the trip was going to take. That left them with a field of one car to choose from. This car, which was transporting tens of thousands of squeaky, bone-shaped rubber dog toys, manufactured in China, shipped by freighter to Seattle, now headed to a big box pet supply chain's distribution center in Southern California. For now, the squeaky bones were held in large cardboard boxes that completely filled the interior of the boxcar to a depth of 6 feet, leaving them 4 feet of living space on the top. Not that they could stand on the loosely packed boxes anyway. The agents and their charge had taped several of the boxes to each other and to the walls so that they could have the door of the boxcar open a bit and not be worried about the cargo falling out unexpectedly and taking one or all of them with it. Still, the three men had to live in a moving, rattling, cacophonous metal box while lying, sitting, crawling, and involuntarily bouncing on a bed of cardboard and thousands of squeaky toys. The din was constant, but not consistent enough to become white noise. Any bump or shimmy on the part of the train, or shift in weight on the part of the men inside the car, caused a spike in the volume of the squeaking. Miller envied his partner, Agent Murphy. At least he had a means of taking an occasional break. Twice a day, they had to check in with their supervisor, but cell phones didn't work if they were too close to Jimmy and his magnetic field. Being trapped inside a steel box with him didn't make the cell phone work any better. So in order to check in, all Agent Murphy, who had no fear of heights, unlike Agent Miller, had to do was swing himself out of the open door of the shaking boxcar, grab the ladder that was just within reach, climb up to the roof of the moving train, and make his way far enough away from Jimmy that his phone would work. This meant walking toward the back of the train and jumping to the next boxcar back. Two cars in front of them was an open bin of some foul-smelling material Miller suspected was used in the manufacture of fertilizer. Miller carefully crawled toward Jimmy, who was lying back on several partially mashed, squeaking boxes, as if they were a deluxe bed in the most expensive suite at the finest hotel. Jimmy was wearing his suit pants and a Seattle PD t-shirt. He had his suit jacket folded and tucked under his head like a pillow. It took great care to move around, not only because the unreliability of the surface made it hard to find footing, but also because it was very easy to carelessly put your weight on one of the seams between the boxes of squeaky toys, meaning that you could be crawling along without a care in the world, then trust your weight to the wrong spot and instantly find yourself falling headfirst between the boxes all the way down to the splintery plywood floor. If that happened, you'd have to crawl your way up, like a man buried alive, to the surface of your squeaking, cardboard-scented grave. Miller finally reached Jimmy. He put his head right up to Jimmy's ear and shouted,
I hate this!
Jimmy smiled and shouted back,
I know!
How can you look so happy?
Miller asked.
Try being a middle-aged white man riding a bicycle through Nicaragua. This is luxury!
Agent Miller put his mouth right up to Jimmy's ear and yelled,
I feel like I'm gonna be sick!
Jimmy replied,
Please don't do it while shouting in my ear!
Miller said,
I should be so lucky!
And carefully slunk back to his corner of the boxcar. He could have stayed where he was, next to Jimmy, but the fact was he wanted as much distance between them as possible. Miller had begun to regret having ever laid eyes on the old coot. Miller thought back to his life before meeting Jimmy. He was half of a two-man task force assigned to investigate and possibly solve a series of possibly connected impossible occurrences that were possibly crimes. They had spent years chasing promising leads and had always come up empty-handed. At the time, it was frustrating, but in retrospect seemed like some kind of golden age. They never enjoyed returning to their office empty-handed, but now they were returning home with their hands full of Jimmy. And it was just as unsavory as it sounded. Their original plan was to stay in Seattle. They would question Jimmy and decide if he was a crackpot or if he was on the level. Either way, they'd get the information they needed and get back to Los Angeles, toot sweet. Unfortunately, Jimmy proved to be both a crackpot and on the level, and instead of just answering their questions, he needed to demonstrate his point, and he had a whole list of weird household items he needed before he could stage his demonstration. It was like trying to interrogate Bill Nye the Science Guy. Most of the items on the list had been easy, things like kite string, binoculars, a large scented candle, things you could get at any department store. The problem had been the last item, a room at least 40 feet in length with a clear line of sight. The Seattle Police Department had no such room in their headquarters, or at least had none that they were willing to hand over to Miller and Murphy. The SPD had started to tire of the two Treasury agents, their weird informant, and the rash of unexplained electronic malfunctions that followed him wherever he went. Murphy had tried to find another facility in Seattle that met Jimmy's specifications, but they all suffered from the same flaw. They cost money to rent, and there was no way the Treasury Department was going to spend money when it had several storage facilities and garages in Los Angeles. Murphy pointed out that transporting Jimmy to California would cost money, but their supervisor pointed out that it would actually be pretty cheap, since, as Murphy himself said, taking an airline flight home was impossible anyway. They quickly researched several possible ways to get Jimmy to L.A. without his magnetic field killing anyone. They considered renting the biggest truck they could and having him ride in the back, but his field would affect any car that tried to pass. They tried to talk their supervisor into renting an antique airplane, but any modern avionics would be useless, risking their safety, and worse, it would cost money. In the end, the boxcar was the only option. Since it is not actually legal to transport humans in a boxcar for any price, the agents had to sneak onto the train with Jimmy, and were now officially hobos, which cost nothing but their dignity. The one resource the Treasury Department was happy to squander with wild abandon. Murphy and Miller found a train that suited their purpose, then happily checked out of their room at the cheapest hotel in the SeaTac Airport District. Their boss had gotten a substantial discount by renting their room on a nightly basis instead of the usual hourly rate plan. They then had to transport Jimmy from the police headquarters to the rail yard, and they couldn't use any car that employed an integrated circuit, because Jimmy would render it inoperable. In the end, an officer was able to loan them his early 70s Cadillac, which was barely operable to begin with. They transported Jimmy in the dead of night to minimize any effect he might have on traffic. The stealthy cloak-and-dagger feel of the operation was spoiled by the Cadillac's faulty wiring, which caused the horn to honk in time with the left turn signal. Agent Miller leaned back into the boxes and a miasma of self-pity.
Maybe if I lay on my back,
he thought,
I'll fall asleep, then throw up and aspirate on my own sick. Then my body will slide between these cursed boxes and slowly sink down into squeaky oblivion.
He fantasized about this for a while. Then his backbone reasserted itself.
No,
he thought.
Without me here, Murphy will just be kind to Jimmy, and I can't allow that to happen. Not after all of this.
Miller forced himself to look out the door of the train. He watched the world pass, fast enough to keep him motion sick, but slow enough to give him no hope of arriving at his destination anytime soon. After a few moments, he saw a single hand swing in from beyond the door and clutch at its frame, knuckles white with exertion. Miller and Jimmy both scrambled as quickly as they dared toward the door. They had been traveling for nearly 2 days. This was the fourth time Murphy had made the transition from clinging to the side of the car to sitting inside, and it had already become routine. It was still utterly terrifying for everyone involved, but the terror was part of the routine. Just one more item on the checklist. Jimmy braced his legs on one side of the doorframe. Miller braced against the door itself. Murphy's second hand joined his first on the edge of the opening, then the very top of his head appeared. He was now standing on the floor of the boxcar, but would not be able to climb up on the stack of boxes without help. Jimmy took one hand, Miller took the other, and with much pulling, kicking, and cursing, he was pulled up onto the surface like a landed fish.
What's the news?
Miller shouted. Murphy lay there, panting from the exertion and the stress. Between gulps of air, he yelled,
They have a facility set aside for us, and suitable transportation will be waiting at the rail yard's employee parking lot. All we have to do is wait for the cover of darkness, then sneak out past the railroad dicks.
Excellent,
Jimmy said.
This is great news. Smile, gentlemen. Things are going well.
That was the last straw. Miller shrieked,
Going well? I'm sick! I haven't slept more than a couple of hours in 2 days, and Murph is having to risk his life twice a day to talk to someone that we both avoid when we're in the same building as him. Then, to top it all off, we just found out that we're gonna have to slink into the city where we both live like criminals!
Yes!
Jimmy said.
Isn't it exciting?
Miller looked at Jimmy, who beamed at him. He looked at Murphy, who shrugged, as if to say, well, he's got a point. Miller considered yelling at them both some more, but instead he simply relaxed and allowed himself to fall between the boxes. Down to the bottom of the squeaking cardboard crevasse. There, he hoped to find some peace.